The Tom Woods Show, episode 1103.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, a lot of people shy away from homeschooling because they think they're going to have to run themselves ragged in order to give their kids a decent education. Not true. Do what I do with my own children and use the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum. They're going to learn stuff they'll never learn anywhere else, and you can keep your mental health. Plus, get $160 worth of free bonuses from my link only, ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. David Gordon is back with us today. Who needs the Library of Congress when you've got David Gordon, said the late Ralph Rako, great libertarian historian. David Gordon is a senior fellow of the Mises Institute. He holds a PhD in intellectual history from UCLA, and he pretty much knows everything about everything. I don't know how to describe for you how brilliant David Gordon is, but it's just ridiculous and embarrassing. You can actually find a memo from Murray Rothbard from, I guess, the late 1970s, where he's writing to somebody and saying, "Today I met a universal genius," and he's referring to David Gordon. Rothbard also said in a note to David himself, "I have been in the scholarly world for a long time, and it is my considered opinion that you are a universal genius unequaled in my experience. The only flaw in your makeup is that you don't seem to have the slightest idea of what a genius you are. The fact that your talents have so far gone unrecognized and untapped is a horrible waste and injustice." That was how Rothbard felt about David Gordon. Well, David has just had a whole bunch of his columns collected into three very sizable volumes, each of which is called An Austro-Libertarian View. I will link to these books, of course, at tomwoods.com/1103. They are a wonderful treasure to have in your collection, and I'm delighted to welcome David back again. We're just going to talk about one of the volumes. We're going to talk about just a bunch of interesting topics in economics and philosophy and see where it goes. David, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Tom. It's good to be back.
So I've just told people we're just going to try to get through one of the volumes, and even there, there's so many we could do an episode on every single topic, but I've just picked out a few that I thought would be interesting. Before we get started, though, although I guess this is from the volume, you do have a piece in there on Hayek as a teacher, because when you were a senior at UCLA, Hayek was a visiting professor of philosophy there, and you actually were sitting in on one of his classes. And I'd be interested to hear what that was like. And it's also interesting, isn't it, that, of course, we know that later in life he branched out into fields other than strictly economics. Isn't it interesting that he could actually get positions teaching those fields when actually his formal training and his academic work was generally all in economics?
Oh yes. Well, he was remarkably broad in his interests. I mean, that the chair he held from UCLA was visiting Flint professor of philosophy. It was a very distinguished position that had been held by some world-renowned philosophers, but they had no problem inviting him. In class, it was very unusual that he would lecture completely without notes. He would be seated at his desk. And when he spoke, although he was speaking without notes, he would deliver his talks as if it were from a written page. You could quite easily publish what he said. People, sometimes when they read Hayek, they find his style very difficult to follow. He was very and rather complicated, long sentences in, say, contrast with Mises or Murray Rothbard, are pretty easy to understand. Sometimes they're dealing with difficult ideas, but the style is pretty straightforward. And they wonder, well, why did Hayek have to be so complicated? And when we're in his class, you saw what the answer was. That was the way he spoke. He was writing just as he spoke.
But in a way, this kind of reminds me of a certain guest of this show whom I'm talking to right now, who can deliver an entire week's worth of political philosophy lectures off the top of his head and have them all be systematic and point by point. In fact, because you did that very thing. You gave a whole seminar on this years and years ago at the Mises Institute, and you just got up and
did that, but of course you wouldn't point that out. I would have to point that out because you're not a braggart, but I'm happy to boast for you. So did you get a chance to speak to Hayek yourself?
Oh yes, I spoke to him a number of times. He was a very quite formal person. I mean, he was friendly but quite reserved, but I did ask him some things. I even told him a few of my jokes, some of which he laughed at. I gave him, for example, the one about the two behaviorist psychologists who meet each other on the street, and one says to the other, you're fine, how am I? And Hayek said, oh yes, that's very amusing.
Very nice. I heard he played Walter Block in chess, and Walter beat him. And then Bob Wenzel said, well, if Tom can beat Walter and Walter can beat Hayek, then surely we can presume that Tom could beat Hayek in chess. I never got to test that theory, but I'm going with it. I'm going to go with that as my theory.
Well, yeah, I mean, it sounds like there's good basis that transitivity of winning applies to chess, but not always, but at least there's some empirical basis for it.
Well, in any case, let's get to things that are probably of more general interest. There are so many pieces in this book, but let's talk about, just because this week I'm thinking about communism and Marxism and Marxism-Leninism because of a talk I'm giving out in California. I guess probably not a million miles from you. It's going to be in Santa Barbara, but not exactly in your backyard. But you have in here a discussion, because a lot of the pieces are book reviews, of Mises on Marx. And I wonder if you think Mises had any unique insights into the problems with Marxism that maybe you'd never seen anywhere before.
Well, one thing he had, I don't think he's the only person who came up with this, but one thing I was very impressed with in his system, there are many criticisms, you know, by Bombaverick and others of the labor theory of value, which is basic to Marxism. But one point that's very few people have had, Mises did have it, is that supposing you accept the labor theory of value, and then the question would come up, well, what determines the wage rates for the worker in the simple model where you start with in Das Kapital, where labor theory applies? Marx says what determines the value of labor is what's required to produce the worker. In other words, what enables the worker to live and reproduce himself. And Mises points out that isn't a consequence at all of the labor theory of value. The labor theory of value leaves the wage indeterminate. There's no answer to that question, what should the wage be within the labor theory of value? So what's valuable there is, if you accept the labor theory of value, Marx's argument that the capitalist employer is paying only for the labor, but getting the labor power of the worker so that he's exploiting the worker by getting the surplus, wouldn't follow. So the whole argument for exploitation that Marx gives is undermined.
Then also, what about Marx's argument about the relationship between the means of production and the various ideas that are current in society, whether they're legal ideas or religious ideas or whatever? Isn't the idea that these things are the superstructure and the means of production would be the base, and that we get these other ideas? It's not like these ideas just exist in a vacuum. It's not like the capitalist idea of what constitutes theft and what constitutes legitimate property holdings just comes about in a vacuum. These ideas come about because the class that has an interest in perpetuating existing property relations develops them, but they emerge out of and are secondary to the existing kinds of means of production that are in use at the time. Now, is that a reasonable description of the situation?
Yes, that was Marx's view, that the ideology is part of the superstructure as opposed to base. Now, one point Mises makes against that, I think it's a very good one.
I think this is where I was going to go about where the means of production, don't they have to come about, for example, through the division of labor?
Right.
And doesn't the division of labor, how would you start that unless you had first had ideas about it? And so wouldn't that show that ideas have to be prior?
Yes, that's exactly Mises' argument, that that Marx is assuming that the forces of production are somewhat of an independent entity just developing on its own, something like the Geist in Hegel's philosophy of history. It's just there, it just keeps developing. But Mises said, no, the forces of production are come about through people's ideas, so it's really ideas that are primary, that are really, really running the course of history. Now, this doesn't exclude that people's ideas can have certain functions in promoting a particular ideology, I mean, promoting particular economic interests or other interests that people have. But there you have to be very careful, what is Mises pointing this out as well, of what's called a genetic fallacy, where you simply assume that because something had a certain function or origin, that explains it. I mean, let's take an example. One of the arguments that Mises gives, and also many other supporters of the free market, is it's undesirable to have taxes on very wealthy people, because the wealthy people will invest their money, and this creates more jobs for workers, more jobs for poor people. So it isn't a good idea to have very heavy heavy taxes. This interferes with investment. Now, some people have pointed out, well, isn't it in the interests of these very wealthy people to have economists writing like that? Because they don't want to pay, at least some of them don't want to pay very high taxes. So isn't it in their interest to have economists supporting them in this way? But even if that's right, it still leaves unanswered the question, is the argument correct? And just one other point to get back to Hayek for a moment. I remember one point he made in his lectures was, if you say that an idea has a certain function, as the Marxists do, say certain ideas will promote class interests, that doesn't explain how those ideas, it doesn't explain, give a causal basis for why people accepted those ideas or how it came about that the ideas were accepted. Just pointing out an idea has a certain function doesn't give you the causal mechanism for it. There's a famous paper by Robert Merton pointing that out that Hayek mentioned. I recall when he referred us to this paper, he said that Merton's about the best of the sociologists. Of course, that isn't saying very much.
No, indeed. I want to talk about other people, but before we do that, there's still one other. What was the one other thing? Oh, yeah. Wouldn't Marx have some kind of a response to Mises' critique that, on the one hand, Marx seems to believe in the iron law of wages, that wages are going to settle at a place where the workers will just be barely able to support themselves and continue to work, but that at the same time he also says that the process that we observe in capitalism is that the workers become progressively worse off. But if they're already at subsistence level, then unless we don't understand what subsistence level means, we can't say that they get worse. If they would all be dead, and therefore there'd be no one to carry forward the socialist revolution, would he really have no comeback to that argument by Mises?
Well, what he might try to say, some Marxists said this, is that it isn't absolute immiseration, as they call it, that Marx had in mind. It was just that there's some historical relativity to this, say, what, say, people in the U.S. would consider very poor would, by, say, standards of the late 19th century, be considered very very well off. I mean, say, you know, poor people today, very often, I've seen street people who have cell phones. So, you know, so you say, well, it isn't that capitalism tends to just drive people to complete subsistence level, but it varies. But the problem with that answer, is if you eliminate the desperation part, then you don't have an ironclad argument at all that the workers are going to find their position so desperate that they're going to revolt. Why should we assume that if, say, workers, according to the Marxist system, are doing all right, they're getting much more than bare subsistence, but their standard of living isn't all that high, or it's not as high as they'd like it to be. That doesn't guarantee that they're going to find the conditions so deplorable they'll revolt. Of course, it doesn't follow from that either that revolt depends on people finding themselves in such bad conditions, such intolerable conditions as bare subsistence. But that's a different argument. If you just take the strict Marxist argument that because the workers were in such bad position, then they're going to inevitably revolt, then the giving up of the absolute miseration is, I think, fatal to that argument.
Let's talk then for a minute about behavioral economics, just in so far as you covered a book called Free Market Madness, Why Human Nature is at Odds with Economics. Now, of course, when they say why human nature is at odds with economics, you know right away that what the person is talking about is not Austrian economics, because we aren't making any claims about, well, I don't know. I don't know if you would say that. Would you? I don't know if we would say we're not making any claims about human nature, but certainly I think we could say we're not claiming that there's something that requires explanation in the fact that people choose to hit the snooze button in the morning instead of being as efficient as people who write books scolding them think they ought to be. We don't think that way. But what's the gist of it? I mean, is this, we just had a behavioral economist win the Nobel Prize, Richard Thaler. What do you think of all this? And I don't remember the details of this particular book, but is the argument that we do things that on paper don't seem to maximize our output or don't seem to be optimal from the point of view of an outside observer, so therefore the free market is stupid? I don't want to, sounds like I'm being frivolous here, but I do think that is what these arguments often wind up being.
Oh yes, well, the ones who use behavioral economics to criticize the market say that according to neoclassical economics, we can show under certain conditions that the market is optimal. But worse, if to do that, you have to assume perfect rationality on the part of people. So what they say is we can show by various experiments that people have what they call cognitive biases, that people are not acting tend not to act in a strictly rational way, meaning by that something like in accord with principles of logic, or sometimes they extend this to mean acting in one's long-term self-interest. An example might be this. Supposing people are asked to estimate the probability of two events, and one event is a more detailed specification of various things than the other event. So we say something like, what is the probability? They give a certain story about a woman called Mary, that she comes from a very isolated background. She's and then she became very active in college in various feminist organizations, and this was extremely important to her. So then they'll ask people, what is the probability, now Mary's graduated from college, what is the probability Mary is a librarian and versus the probability Mary is a librarian and she's a member of a local feminist organization? So a number of people sometimes will answer that the second alternative, that Mary is a librarian and the member of the feminist organization, is higher probability than the first one, that Mary's just a librarian. But that can't be the case, because whatever the probability is, Mary is a librarian. If you just add something to it, you can't get a higher probability. The second alternative is true. So they say, well, we can show people make these various mistakes in reasoning. So it isn't the case that the neoclassicals are wrong, that the market people don't always act in a perfectly rational way. So we can't assume then that the market is optimal. But as you point out when you ask a question, in Austrian economics, we don't assume this. The notion of rationality employs an extremely weak one, that people use means to attain an end. So if you have a certain goal, you think something will help you achieve that. You're not making any supposition on how rational the person is from some point of view of logic or reasonable beliefs, or that the person is reasonable. For example, suppose someone wants to make a lot of money, and he spends a lot of money on a lottery where he'll have very little chance of winning. Many of the behavioral economists would say, oh, this isn't rational, because given the vast odds against winning a lottery, say if you buy $200 worth of lottery tickets, you're in effect throwing away your money. That isn't a very good way of trying to make money. But from the Austrian perspective, as long as the person thinks that that's a way to win money, that counts as rational. So the Austrians aren't assuming rationality in the way the behavioral economists have challenged. So the Austrians were immune to that sort of criticism.
Do you think the behavioral economists, though, have identified any, let's say, puzzles or anything that ought to make us say, that's curious. I wonder what the explanation for that is. Is it possible that they've done that, but yet at the same time, not actually fundamentally undercut real economics?
Oh yes, I think that's exactly right. They've raised certain interesting questions about individual psychology and ask why do people make certain choices. That, in Mises and other Austrian economists, recognize that's a perfectly legitimate topic to investigate. But Austrian economics is interested in the structure of action rather than why people make certain choices. Now, a point that's very relevant here is, you say, well, supposing I'm right, which occasionally I am, I hope, that Austrian economics is immune to this sort of criticism. People might say, okay, well, doesn't this, though, undermine the argument that many Austrians are also strong supporters of the free market? People say, well, we should just let the market operate without government interference. The claim might be, if people are irrational or not always rational in the way that the behavioral economists point out, doesn't this give us reason to think that it might sometimes be justifiable to interfere with what people are doing, or at least, as Thaler and Cass Sunstein say, to nudge them in certain directions? But a big problem with, if you say that, is that's assuming that the government or whoever is making these decisions are themselves immune to these kind of cognitive problems, and are less likely to have them, and also acting in the interests of the people who are supposed to be benefited by their interference. And both are very questionable assumptions, to say the least. As we know from public choice theory, the government actors have their own interests. They're not just selfless advocates of the so-called public interest. Sunstein explicitly says he thinks that experts are better at choice and are more rational than ordinary people. But this, to me, seems highly questionable. It's a very self-serving view, which doesn't refute it. But nevertheless, I think it's perhaps an example of the cognitive biases that he's supposed to be writing about, that he is writing about.
David, there is so much here. I hardly know what to talk about next, but let's take just a minute to thank our sponsor, Skillshare, which is like the Netflix of online learning. It's an online learning platform with over 18,000 classes in business, marketing, technology, entrepreneurship, and more. You can take classes in productivity and time management, social media strategy, Google Analytics, you name it, they've got it. Unfortunately, in our society, we've gotten into this mentality whereby once your formal education is complete, well, there's nothing more to learn. But of course, you're just getting started. We should be learning our entire lives. I don't need to tell that to this audience, which I know craves knowledge. But Skillshare in particular will help to give you a leg up in your job, will help to give you an extra skill that you can use for a side hustle or even your own business. I've gone through it and I cannot believe what is being offered. And speaking of what's being offered, Tom Woods Show listeners are getting 2 months of unlimited access to over 18,000 classes for just 99 cents. How can you not do that? To sign up, go to Skillshare.com/Woods. Again, go to Skillshare.com/Woods to start your 2 months now. That's Skillshare.com/Woods. There's one more person I want to pick your brain about at some length, and that's John Rawls. Now, I read in your book a little something about Gordon Tullock, who I don't know if he mentioned Rawls in particular, but he said something along the lines of he's not entirely convinced when people say they want something, but then they don't act in a way that indicates that they want that thing. And so when people say, I want to help the poor, but then their actions don't actually involve helping the poorest, the very poorest people, then he's just very skeptical that that's really what they want. And that reminded me a little bit of Rawls, because Rawls, of course, is an egalitarian, and he does claim to want to help the poor. But, and I believe you speculate on this, as to what his motivations are, he does not say that we therefore need to have massive redistribution from the United States to third world countries, even though the arguments for why that would be morally required are identical to the arguments that he uses that would make redistribution between individuals be morally required. And given that national borders are morally arbitrary, then why shouldn't we have international redistribution? And your speculation, I don't know if this was you, maybe I'm misremembering, was that he knows he can take his egalitarianism only so far, and that the professors in the faculty lounge, they like to talk about egalitarianism, but at the end of the day, even though I hate that dumb expression, they like to have their wine and cheese parties. They don't really want to give all their stuff away to the third world, and he gives them a comfortable rationalization for why they don't have to do it. So before we get into Rawls's idea, is that something that you speculated, or did I dream that up?
Oh, I don't think entirely dreamed it up. I think I did say something like this. Possibly I also said what you said, but I thought it was interesting that many of the egalitarians, especially philosophy professors or economists, egalitarians, who political scientists who favor this, if you ask them, well, okay, you favor equality, what should be the upper bounds of people's wealth and income? It would be, and they would give you something that's slightly above the standard that they themselves have. So it seemed, I thought it was interesting that they came up with this. And I think also, although this certainly doesn't refute Rawls, I think his philosophy was very much attuned to, say, what liberal Democrats in the, say, the when JFK was president would have supported, what that, say, if you were, say, today, if you're a Hillary Clinton supporter, you'd find Rawls's views very much along your lines where I say, supposing someone favored complete egalitarian distribution worldwide, which would very much lower the standard of living for Americans, although there are some leftists who favor that, they wouldn't get as big of a following. But as I said, with the Marxist, when it's criticizing the Marxist view, that doesn't by itself refute what someone is saying. You know, if you can show interests that they have in promoting certain ideas. And what Rawls, I think, would respond there is that he takes it as a starting point that we're talking about justice, we're talking from within a particular society, something like a nation state. So he takes that as his starting point. If he doesn't assume kind of a general position where we're taking everyone in the world and saying what is the appropriate distribution of wealth or income for everyone in the world, he takes it as a starting point that societies are sort of at least in part separate entities, and we're talking about the injustice as a matter of how the benefits of cooperation would be distributed among the members of a particular society. In his book, The Law of Peoples, he's very much opposed to worldwide redistribution, although he does think there's some duties of foreign aid. These are much less exigent, say, than helping the worst off class within our own nation. And sometimes, I think I point out in my review, you can actually use some of the arguments Rawls gives against redistribution from nation to nation could actually be used against redistribution within the U.S. or other nation state. For example, he said, well, why should say nation people, particular nation, been very hard working and have built up their economy, why should they have to benefit countries that say haven't been so hard working? And of course, you could use a similar argument against redistribution within a society. But this is the point though that Rawls confined justice to particular societies. One, a lot of critics have raised against him, but this is really integral to his way of conceiving justice. He did think that justice depends on the particular ties people within a certain society have to each other, and there aren't cosmopolitan principles that apply universally, or at least if there are such principles, they're not as demanding as the ones that apply within a particular society. So it's a perspective that a lot of his critics, I mean, not just libertarian critics, but a lot of his critics in mainstream political philosophy don't accept, but it is basic. Thomas Nagel's one of the philosophers, was Rawls's student, is one of the philosophers who's stressed this aspect of Rawls very effectively, that his system is based on what's just within a particular society rather than universally.
All right, the last thing I want to ask, of course, is the most fundamental question of all. I'm still interested in the Rawls question. Let's make sure everybody is following along. John Rawls wrote the book A Theory of Justice, whose influence it is just impossible to overstate in terms of a 20th century book on political thought. It's just everywhere. It's discussed in classrooms and just everywhere. And it has to do with the idea, and I don't want to explain it in a way that's not fair to it, but I want to explain it in a way that I can keep it within a few minutes. The gist of it is that if you were behind a so-called veil of ignorance, that is to say, you're about to enter the world, but you don't know what your position in that world is going to be. So you don't know if you're going to be a man or a woman, or smart or dumb, or strong or weak, or any of these things. What if you didn't have any of this knowledge, would you want the rules of that society to be? And he thinks that given that you don't know if you're going to be successful or not, you don't know if you're going to be a millionaire or something, then what you would want is to hedge your bets. You would want a society in which the least among you are taken care of and assured of a reasonable comfort. So you would favor a reasonably egalitarian distribution of resources just to make sure that even if you wind up in the worst possible condition when you're in the world, it won't be so bad because you will have been provided for by egalitarian rules of that society. Is that a fair summary?
Yes, I think that's very good. But one point, and this is one that's often missed, when Rawls is talking about the people behind the veil of ignorance at this basic level, when he talks about the worst off class, he means the worst off class who are still contributing or still producing. I mean, the argument wouldn't be something like, suppose I think I might end up just completely physically disabled, so I wouldn't be able to do anything. Wouldn't I want to take care of that? He's talking about the least well-off productive people. And in his system, although, we do have obligations to take care of a very disabled, the people who aren't contributing at all, this isn't part of the absolutely basic principles of justice that would be coming at a later level. I mean, say, we're severely mentally retarded people or people who are really, the idea behind his system is, suppose, say, we were cooperating on something, we're in a business and we don't really know what our abilities are, but we know we're going to benefit from this business. If we're each going to be contributing, we're going to benefit. We don't know really what abilities we have. So we want to, in his view, we want to come up with an arrangement, if we don't know, where, as you say, we'll make sure we're not really in an awful position. And one reason he thinks that, some people say, aren't you assuming that people are risk averse? No, he's saying that what's important in his system, that we have enough of the basic goods, in which powers and liberties and various other things, so that we're able to get on. And what above that doesn't count as much in leading a good life. So for him, it's the essential is that people try to ensure that they'll get a sufficient amount of what's necessary to lead a good life rather than gamble on whether they can get more and take the chance that they won't come up with very much of anything.
Okay, so if that is the way he's positioning us, then what's wrong with this? Is there something wrong with this construct, or is there something wrong in his reasoning? What would you say? I mean, of course, you could have somebody like Gary Chartier, who I discussed with, because, of course, he has a book called, I think it's called Writing Rawls. Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Or no, maybe that was the name of the episode.
I think it's...
that was the name of the episode I called it.
I think it's called something with Rawls in the title. Well, it's interesting you mention his books. See, now, he argues, you can get to anarchist conclusions, sort of favoring a free market on Rawlsian principles. But you see, I read the book before it was published. He sent it to me. Although I think it's a very interesting book people should read, I don't think he's really grasped the Rawls's system at all. I mean, what he's come up with are just arguments for the free market or arguments for anarchism, libertarian anarchism. And he said, since these are good arguments, people would choose them behind the original position. But the basic idea of Rawls isn't just an original position where you assume people don't know anything. All that you get with that would be, people would just be choosing on an impartial basis. So the original position there isn't adding anything to his argument. The basic thing you need to have a Rawlsian system is that you view everything that is up for distribution, you regard everything as a collective asset that subject, and people have to decide how are we going to distribute this among society. So unless you make that assumption, you don't have a Rawlsian view at all. And you know, I don't think you can really get to a free market conclusion from that premise. And that assumption, I think, is one of the things that's, to get back to your question, what is wrong with the Rawls's starting point is that it starts from the view that everything is really up for decision, that it isn't, say, that people have natural rights to property. It's that people in the society are coming together to decide how their goods should be distributed, how the goods, benefits, and social cooperation should be distributed. If you don't have that starting point, then you won't accept the Rawls's point of view. Now, another criticism one can make of Rawls, this is one Dworkin has raised. Ronald Dworkin is a great legal philosopher, very sympathetic to Rawls's style conclusions, but he raised the point, well, supposing people, self-interested actors under Rawls's conditions, would come up with his principles of justice, you could say, well, so what? Why should we take that as a starting point? Rawls would need argument, he tries to provide this, but probably questionable whether he succeeds. Why is it relevant that people from a certain starting point would arrive at certain principles? Why should that give us reason to accept those principles just because, given the starting point, people would arrive at these principles? And the last sort of criticism one could make of the Rawlsian construction is people could say people wouldn't come up with those conclusions under Rawls' assumption. John Harsanyi, who was a very well-known economist who had a similar framework for thinking about moral questions, argued that people in those circumstances would come up with a more utilitarian system in which they would favor people getting more in accord with what would maximize their prospects for income and wealth rather than trying to ensure that they got a minimum at whatever cost. So their arguments, even within the framework of the original position, whether Rawls has come up with the right answers, although he has reasons for thinking that he has come up with these answers. So the question isn't, I wouldn't say settled against him, but he's been challenged on that basis.
The book we were thinking of, by the way, is Radicalizing Rawls. That was Chartier's book, Radicalizing Rawls.
Yes.
So in other words, you would say that if I were to say something like, Rawls's requirements would be best satisfied by a free market, because in a free market, the poorest tend to be better off than they are in any other system, so therefore we should favor that. This neglects the fact that Rawls takes for granted that we're dealing with the idea of basically the collective ownership of all the stuff in society, and we're just trying to think of how we should sort that all out. Like, he's already stacked the deck against a market outcome. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. I mean, supposing you say you give an argument like that, that the free market tends to help poor people more than other systems. That's a very good argument. I think it's right. But what are you adding to that by saying people in the original position would choose that? All that you're saying there is you're saying, well, I think if people were choosing impartially on what's best for society, they would pick that. But that isn't a particular, that doesn't give you any kind of distinctive approach to political philosophy. All that you could just wipe out the Rawlsian window dressing to it and just say, well, you know, the argument is we should have the free market because this helps poor people the most, and we think this is a good thing to do is to help the poor people. there's no distinctive Rawlsian system there at all. The Rawlsian idea is, as you mentioned your question, that you're taking everything as a collective asset and asking about redistribution. Now, in Chartier's book, it's interesting. He gives a criticism of Rawls on this point. He says, well, you know, Rawls is assuming this and we shouldn't assume this. But then at the same time, he tries to argue on that you can get a Rawlsian argument for the free market, but the basic assumption which he's questioned of Rawls' system is that everything is to be taken as a collective asset subject to redistribution, and you don't have a Rawlsian project unless you incorporate that assumption, or at least I don't think you do.
Well, the book is An Austro-Libertarian View, and we have been looking at Volume 1 only, which is Economics, Philosophy, and Law. There are three of these volumes, if you can believe that, and it would take really another 1,100 podcast episodes to get through all the material in them. Imagine it's the closest you're going to getting access to all the knowledge in David Gordon's brain. So I'm going to link to these books at tomwoods.com/1103. And David, thank you very much, and I very much do hope to see you at the Austrian Economics Research Conference at the Mises Institute next month.
Oh, thanks, Tom. I look forward to that, and thanks for having me on your show.
All right, everybody. If you missed my talk at the University of California at Santa Barbara, which is taking place tonight, if you're listening to this episode on the day of release, well, I'm going to have a version of it. I'm going to just tell you what I said to folks there in tomorrow's episode, 1104. So make sure you have subscribed. Find the subscription links. Of course, you subscribe to the show for free at tomwoods.com/episodes. You'll find the subscription links there, as well as links to every single one of the 1103 episodes so far. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.